You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good evening. My name is Celine Nwulu. I am a writer and I'm also a researcher here at the RSA in the Creative Learning and Development team. And it is my great pleasure to welcome you to this evening's special event, which we're delighted to be staging in partnership with ECIS, the Educational Collaborative for International Schools, and with Save the Children. Now, tonight's event comes at the end of a year-long investigation that the RSA has been carrying out with ECIS into how cities can respond more creatively and collaboratively to the challenge of supporting refugee young people in their education. Although the scale of the challenge is very real, we believe that there is an opportunity to change the public narrative around global migration and what is widely known as the refugee crisis by highlighting the many ways in which organisations and individuals worldwide are stepping up with solutions and support and working with one another to create lasting change. Our forthcoming report, Cities of Reciprocity, makes the case for this and makes the case for more interconnected responses to refugee education across cities. And my colleague Alice Sack-Ryder will certainly be reflecting on some of our thinking in a little while. But this evening, we really want to begin to highlight some of the innovative work that we've come across so far and to invite those working in this space to also share their experiences with us. So this evening, we're absolutely delighted to welcome Kevin Watkins and Charlotte Balfour Poole, CEO and Senior Education in Emergency Advisor, respectively, for Save the Children, the world's leading children's organisation. We also have Alice Sack-Ryder, an RSA Associate and Creative Researcher on Migrant Integration, who is a fellow co-author of the forthcoming report, Cities of Reciprocity. And we have Gulwale Pasale, a former political refugee from Afghanistan who now lives in the UK and is the youth ambassador for the global children's charity, Their World. So as you can see, we have an absolute depth, an array of experience on this panel tonight, and I'm more than honoured to be chairing. Kevin will be the first to talk tonight, but before that, I'd like to just introduce a short film that I think really speaks very powerfully to the discussion that we're going to have tonight and shows just how much education matters to young people around the world facing the trauma of displacement. So the film is called I Ran With The Books.
They were killing everyone, whether you are a man, woman, a young, whatever. Someone is being killed ahead of you, and someone is being killed behind of you, and you are still running. I ran with the books. Even I did not run with any clothes, but I just ran with the books. I was holding this book. This book now is very old, but I have to take care of it. When I arrive here, I find that there is no school for students. It has really spoiled our life, and it has spoiled our development.
If I will be the minister, I will let all the children go to school.
When they see a crisis have happened, they have to open a high school for the student and even primary school so that all the students will get education. If the children of the country are educated, they will bring up the country.
I can be a minister, doctor, teacher, or what if I am educated.
I have to plan for my future. I have to look for education. So I must have education, unless I'm dead. But if I'm alive, I must achieve.
Kevin, if you'd like to begin.
Thank you so much. And I wanted to start by thanking the RSA for holding this event. It's actually really apposite that we're having this discussion here because there's a wonderful sentence on a mission statement actually on the front page of the RSI site, which says that we believe that all people have creative potential, which when supported and understood can create the conditions for a 21st century enlightenment. And the theme of what I want to say really is that we are standing by and turning our backs collectively as an international community on kids like Grace and Anna. And it's something I actually feel very angry about, and as an organisation we're very heavily involved in, that we have 6 million registered refugee children in the world, registered to the United Nations Refugee Agency. Of those children, 60% are out of school. You know, kids like this are out of school. That is the destruction of human potential on an unimaginable scale. And really the theme of what I want to say is that these kids have a right to expect something better from all of us, and that we should make universal education for refugees one of our overarching and most pressing of all development priorities. Just to get behind the numbers, because sometimes when you throw out these figures, you know, 6 million refugees and 3.7 million out of school, to give you a sense of what we're talking about, if you take a country like Syria, 7 years ago, before the war started, this was a country that had almost achieved universal lower secondary education. It was on a par with Thailand, actually. Syrian refugee children now have refugee indicators on a par with Mali or Chad. In the space of a single primary school generation, this is the greatest reversal in education, probably in human history, actually, if you think about it in that way. And we have to ask ourselves, was that inevitable? You know, you can argue about the conditions for the war, but for those 3 million Syrian children who have fled the country, who are living in neighbouring states mostly, fewer than half of whom are in school, was that inevitable? You know, could the international community have done something different for those children? I'll come back to what we could have done in a moment. If you think of what is going on now off the radar screen of the international media, it's another refugee crisis, this time in northern Uganda, where in the space of really just a few months, we've had 1.6 million South Sudanese refugees who have fled into northern Uganda. The biggest settlement is in an area called Bidi Bidi. The current enrolment rate in that settlement is probably in the order of 20%. So we have in that settlement at least 60,000 children who are out of school, and that settlement is probably the best performing part of the refugee response internationally. So, you know, there are probably upwards of 500,000 of those refugee kids from South Sudan who are out of school. And the international community has sat on its hands, it's watched this unfold, and it's done almost nothing. And what I want to do is really two things, because I don't want to depress everybody right at the start of the show. is first of all, just to give you my sense of what I think is going wrong in the system and how we can fix it. So what is going wrong in the system is, first of all, most of the refugee crises that we're dealing with now are long-term. The typical period of displacement is around 20 years. The current humanitarian architecture, in everything it does, is short-term. It raises short-term money. It delivers it on a short-term basis through agencies that are all operating separately. So you don't have a joined-up plan. Ask yourself how you would feel about having the education system for your children funded by short-term voluntary donations, which go up or down depending on the media interest in your part of the country. That's what we're doing with refugees. That is completely unacceptable. So we need a humanitarian architecture that reflects the realities facing refugee children, not the architecture that we've got. The second problem that we have in the humanitarian system is the limited priority attached to education. I've spoken to an awful lot of refugee children and their parents. And the thing that I'm always struck by, and you know, I'm not going to try and capture it in words here, is the heroism of parents who have lost everything, you know, who have suffered trauma, who have seen people killed, who have been uprooted from their country, are trying to settle somewhere else, who will move heaven and earth to get their kids into school. You speak to kids, they're desperate to get back into school. Those kids there, from one of the poorest countries in the world. I've spoken to kids in Bekaa Valley, in fields, picking fruit, who think they're going to raise enough money so that they can get back into an education. So they're sending a very clear signal. We care about education because we see it as a way of rebuilding our lives. What is the international community's response? Well, something like 1-2% of humanitarian appeals are directed to education. That's bad enough. But of that 1-2% in the appeal, less than half is usually delivered. And they call this a needs-based assessment approach. It's not a needs-based assessment approach. It's a cop-out by the international community from one of the great development challenges that are facing us. The third problem is rules and regulations. I've done a lot of work in Lebanon. You speak to kids from Ghouta or Aleppo who have suffered the most appalling atrocities that arrive in a country that they don't know. They've been traumatised. The first thing they have to do, if they want to get into the school system, is learn French, because maths is taught in French. Is this really a smart move? You've got tens of thousands of displaced Syrian teachers who the rules forbid from being hired to teach refugee children. These are administrative barriers which can be moved. Many countries have done it. Lebanon has started to do it now, actually, in Jordan and others. A fourth problem is refugee poverty. 70% of the refugees, of the Syrian refugees in Lebanon, are living below the poverty line. And if you want to understand what is driving kids into labour markets, not just in Lebanon, but in Jordan, and you can see them on the streets. You go to Beirut or Amman or other parts of the world, and they're out there working. That's a function of poverty and the fact that the savings of their parents are being eroded. Now, why is this such a tragedy? It's a tragedy for many reasons. Every kid everywhere in the world deserves the opportunity of a decent quality education. But these kids doubly deserve it, and I'll tell you why. It's first of all, these are kids who, for the most part, have been traumatised. They've seen appalling stuff. They've witnessed appalling stuff. They've been subject to the murderous activities of President Assad, of armed militias in South Sudan, of a murderous government in South Sudan. We did a survey of children affected by conflict in Syria. 70% of them had symptoms of toxic stress, urinating, inability to sleep, being extremely withdrawn. Getting them back into school, providing them with a decent counselling in a school-based environment can be the first step to rebuilding their lives. We're denying them that opportunity. Secondly, these kids have got a tough ticket in life. They need a chance to build the skills, to build the confidence that they will need as adolescents and adults to build a better life for themselves, to contribute either to the host country or back in their home country. And again, if you talk to them, the ambition is extraordinary. I've been in a room full of refugee kids in Beirut, and you ask them what they want to do. These are kids who've lost everything. They're not even in school. Half of them are working. You say, what do you want to be? They all want to be doctors, engineers, architects. None of them wants to head an international NGO, I should say, but maybe for good reason. So we should be supporting their ambition. And the way that we can do it, this is going to be part of the wider discussion we have here, is first of all, we need to finance universal provision for refugee education. Now, Gordon Brown, who's the UN Special Envoy for Education, has come up, I think, with an incredibly innovative and practical and deliverable proposal that could pump $9 billion worth of funding into global education. This could make a difference. This is how you mobilise long-term resources on the scale that we need. We have organisations like the Global Partnership for Education, like the World Bank, which could be doing far more. I ask a very simple question. We have a strategy for education in the UK. Virtually every country in Africa has a national education strategy which aims to get all children into school. Why don't we have a strategy for getting every South Sudanese refugee child into school or every Syrian refugee child into school. We don't have it because we have a fragmented planning architecture that's out of step with the realities of those children. You know, we're not working sufficiently with municipal authorities around the world to make education possible. And we're not tackling the poverty that is driving so many of these kids out of school, partly because we don't let refugees work, partly because we're not doing cash transfer programs on a sufficient scale. But if we did all of these things, you know, we're not talking about rocket science here. We're talking about building a decent school structure, about hiring a refugee teacher, providing some basic books, and giving these kids a chance in life. You know, these are children who have had crimes committed against them. They deserve our best effort. They're not getting our best effort, and we have to do better. So I'll leave it there. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Kevin. Brilliant. Thank you very much. And I think that particularly sets the foundation for which, you know, other conversations will emerge tonight. Charlotte, can I bring you in now, perhaps to reflect on some of the opportunities and also barriers to implementing education on the ground and referring to certain examples, if they're relevant, from Promising Practices?
Sure. So firstly, I'd just like to thank the RSA for hosting this event, because I think it's such a pertinent issue and something that cuts across all of society and something that a lot of people feel very passionately about and quite, as Kevin's very beautifully highlighted, angry about as well. And I think that anger is the right emotion that we should be feeling. As Kevin mentioned, education in emergencies and education in refugee and protracted crises is severely underfunded. The scale of the problem is absolutely huge. And so far, only small commitments have been made in terms of providing transformative change. And I would actually argue that a lot of those commitments are pithy at best. We haven't shaken up the system, a system that was built arguably for a very different crisis. So I wanted to also just say how humbled I am to have the chance to present on some of the operational challenges. I sit in the headquarters of Save the Children in London, and there are some of our staff who are working tirelessly in the field. But most importantly, the families and children who have shared their stories and upheavals with us, it's those individuals that are battling every single day with the hardship and seeking refuge, and fundamentally about attempting to secure an education for their children and a better future is all they want. So I wanted to highlight the persistence, resilience and sheer determination of countless refugees as agents of change and not as passive recipients of aid, which I think is something that media here is very good at portraying. And we're very lucky to have Gulwali here with us today, who's a wonderful example, and I know he'll share his story. But another example is Najeen Mustafa, who some of you may have heard of. Najeen has cerebral palsy and cannot walk, but this didn't stop her braving inconceivable odds to travel in a wheelchair from Syria and finally to Germany to seek an education and medical treatment you needed. And she's written a wonderful book with Christina Lam called The Girl from Aleppo, which you can read more about her story. But I want to use Najeen's story to really highlight my first point, and that is that children, parents and communities demand education regardless of the context. Often we think of it as something that comes later or that people aren't really that worried about. But we conducted a joint piece of research with the Norwegian Refugee Council called Hear It From the Children. And that was very much looking at the role of education for conflict-affected communities, both in DRC and in Somalia, on the refugee in Ethiopia, looking at Somalian refugees. And I just want to, I think the film highlights some of the, you know, the power of children's voices as well. And they can speak much more eloquently than I can. So I just wanted to take some of their words. Education is what allows you to have a future. Education will help you forever, not just today. And whatever happens, my knowledge will always be with me. And with that, I can continue my life. And many parents and community leaders reiterated that without an education, I'm like a blind man. So I think the importance of education cannot be reiterated. And all of us probably in this room are in this room today because we've had that chance. Kevin highlighted the international community is still not prioritising education. And I think that comes to my second point around one of the biggest challenges is around the speed and the scale of the response. So education in humanitarian context is severely neglected and underfunded. often our own education emergency responses are very slow to get started and get off the ground. And it becomes challenging to sustain the level of support needed to keep children in school and keep them learning over protracted crises. And I think we're seeing this more and more so, as the average length a child spends in refugee camps is now 17 years, as we can see in Kenya in the Dadaab refugee camp. So it's likely that many of the children crossing borders today will spend their whole childhoods, if not their whole lives, in refugee settlements. And therefore, reiterating Kevin's point that planning and funding must meet both immediate, medium and short-term needs of refugees. It's not good enough for us to have the current architecture that we have. And I think an interesting point was during the European refugee migrant crisis, it was incredibly challenging for us to provide education to children on the move, as families were often moving every couple of hours, every couple of days, and with complete unpredictable regularity. At the height of the European crises, with border closures and movements of people, it wasn't possible for us to hold even the most informal of classes or learning opportunities for children, which is deeply frustrating. But I think we need to be better at thinking about how we can provide that to children on the move. And there's a number of my colleagues from other agencies in the audience who I know have worked tirelessly on this. But we still need to do much more to collaborate around solutions. So both Save the Children and other agencies are stretched. We're responding to a wide range of refugee contexts: Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey, Uganda, Ethiopia, and Europe, just to name a few, with limited funding and limited resources to do so. And it's very much seen by the humanitarian community as a quick solution, and we're not thinking about it in the longer term and how we better link up. And this comes to my third point, which is around the challenge of the quality of the response. So one of the key purposes of education in emergencies is to provide that immediate safety, immediate psychosocial support. But ultimately, it's about providing a safe passageway in order to the resumption of formal learning. And that can happen after a week, that can happen after a month, recognising what children have been through in some of those traumatic experiences. But again, in order to have that response and that resumption of formal learning, that requires dedicated resources, good coordination, and a commitment to the provision of a more formal quality learning opportunities. And our experience from Europe response was that despite being in middle-income countries and developed countries, there were huge barriers for refugees accessing education. And these included bureaucracy, lack of resources, and also slow processes which prevented children. And I know the research will touch on some of the examples from Greece. But on the other hand, I think there's some very positive examples that are coming out of that research. But despite an announcement from the Ministry of Education over 10 months ago declaring that a plan for all refugee children to attend special shifts in local schools, almost a year later, the majority of children living in camps and urban areas are still out of school. And Save the Children and other agencies are continuing to provide non-formal education opportunities in reception centres and urban areas, but not that provision of formal education. And many of you will be familiar with Zaatari camp in Jordan, where Syrian teachers are only able to provide classroom support alongside Jordanian teachers in order to not disrupt Jordanian teacher profession. And similarly, in Lebanon, as Kevin mentioned, due to strict labour laws, Syrian teachers are unable to use their skills, expertise and cultural knowledge to teach. Instead, Syrian children are hosted in double shifts within existing Lebanese schools, and often required to speak French. So for refugees who do not have access to education, poor quality teaching, often by untrained volunteers in classrooms which lack the most basic supplies, means that their learning is severely compromised. However, you'll be pleased to know it's not all doom and gloom, as the Promising Practice work highlights. And this Promising Practices is an emerging piece, so there are still some examples that are coming through. And there's some very exciting initiatives being taken by a wide range of partners. And I think it's really exciting to finally be having some of that dialogue around what are the positive things that are happening on different fronts. And some of you may be familiar with the Interagency Network for Education in Emergencies. There's much greater and enhanced collaboration now in order to increase the profile and awareness for the plight of refugee education. So just some key opportunities that I thought would be interesting to highlight. So the provision of flexible learning approaches for children are on the move. So in Serbia, there were cultural mediators and facilitators on hand to lead language and psychosocial support activities whenever young people were gathered in urban centres such as queues for food. So although that might seem like a tiny drop in the ocean, that small provision can provide that continuity and that ability for children to feel that their education is important and there is a chance. I think we can also learn some great lessons from countries such as Uganda, which welcomes and empowers refugees through a right to work and a freedom of movement, rather than encamping children. But obviously, the scale of that crisis is huge and the displacement is huge. So as a result, we need to be able to much better provide temporary schools at scale. So at the moment, that's happening on a very micro scale. But in order to meet the needs of all of those children, it needs to be happening on a much greater scale. And that also, with a mid to long-term scale, there's a thought about how we're going to integrate within the wider formal system and not have a situation like we have in Dadaab refugee camp, where children aren't then able to work or to go into the Kenyan system. I think the other interesting example is the use of technology, and we're seeing a lot of technology firms, Google, Facebook, are all very interested and very keen to connect with agencies such as ourselves, which I think is a fantastic opportunity. I would just want to highlight that I think technology isn't necessarily the solution. What is important is the learning that comes with that. And what is it, the content is much more important than the tool. So just giving a child a laptop isn't going to mean that they're suddenly getting a better education. And an example of this is Save the Children and Pearson have got a joint partnership called Every Child Learning Partnership, which we have researched and developed some education solutions with an integrated digital learning application and now piloting some of those solutions for children in Jordan affected by the Syria crisis. So there's lots of exciting things happening and a lot more coming out in the next couple of months. And I think all of you in this room, by demonstrating your commitment, is a really great way to start the conversation and to try and share some of that learning and better collaborate about ideas of how we can address some of these solutions. So I just wanted to leave you with a quote from a 13-year-old boy as to why education matters for all. "With education, I think I will have a future that won't have to engulf guns and fighting. This is my dream, that I can look into my future and see that I have options and choices. Without school, you have no choices in life. You are just trying to survive." Thank you.
Thank you very much for that, Charlotte. And it's particularly helpful to get specific, concrete examples just so that we can fully understand the scale of the problem as well as the opportunities. I think this then works quite well for Alice to start talking about the work that we've been doing at the RSA and certainly what we've been thinking about in this space.
Great, thanks, Lena. So I've been working as an associate with the RSA over the past year, and it's always really challenging to try to kind of distill everything that you've been doing down as a researcher into a short presentation like this, but I'm going to do my best to just give you a bit of an overview of the sort of work that we've been doing. So to go back to 2015, the RSA wrote a think piece. And it was all about how international schools can grow their social mission. There was a real sense that international schools could actually really become global thought leaders and that they operate in a very interesting environment. They're globally minded, they're innovating around education. And so the RSA wrote this think piece looking at how international schools could really become these creative communities with a cause. And that think piece then led on to a piece of research that we've been working on, which is looking at refugee education, but with a particular focus on Athens as a case study. So we've been working on this project for the past year, and we had a fantastic summit back in November, and it was great to get a whole set of different people from all across Athens and globally as well to come together and to talk about these issues. And we found huge depths of resilience, wonderful organisations that are doing great work in the city environment. And in the face of what is a deeply challenging situation, actually coming up with some really great projects and some great ideas. Some of the things that came out of the summit were the sense that reciprocity is important, that actually there are a lot of actors in the city environment who can give something, but who might need something in return. And it was a real sort of part of the summit that we started talking about, well, what can I give, but what could you give me in return? We found that technology was a really important area, just like Charlotte was saying. It's not necessarily the be-all and end-all, but it's a really important area. Projects like TechFugees are doing really great work, bringing tech communities together to look at what sort of ways they can come up with solutions. And another thing that was really important for us at the conference was to ensure that refugee voices were there, that they were present. So we contacted someone called Deya Ofali, and he is the coordinator of a school that's based just on the outskirts of Athens in a refugee camp called Skaramagas. And Deya and his colleague Abdul Ghani were at the conference. And it was great to hear their views, to get their perspective on the challenges that they and the children that they were supporting faced. And these guys, they're kind of in their mid-20s, they're from Syria, and they just got fed up with seeing the children running around in the refugee camp, and they decided to do something about it. So they got some shipping containers, they brought the kids together, and they started teaching them. And Deya said, he talked about how he doesn't accept money, but he accepts offers of support. He'll accept a laptop or a computer or a volunteer, but he doesn't want money. And that sense of that need for exchange really came out of that. So when we held the summit, it was held at ACS Athens, which is a international community school based in Athens. And what has been fantastic to see over the past, sort of since the summit in November, is just how much ACS Athens have really recognised that they are a player in this field, that as an international school holding a great deal of privilege, they can actually do something to make a difference in this area. It started very small. They started by taking on 4 unaccompanied minors, and they brought them into the school environment, and they started supporting them with their education. And the international school community within Athens, in this ACS Athens school, the students started to kind of press for more, and they said that we want to do more, we want to support more children. And so recently they've actually upped the number of refugees that they're supporting. They now have 36 unaccompanied minors. And 2 of these children, they've actually managed to find their parents, and they're in the process of trying to reunite them. Now, I know it's just a small drop in the ocean in comparison to the, you know, I think it's around 20,000 or so young people that are in Athens. But I think what we felt was really important coming out of this summit is that actually in pockets all over the city, you have people who are passionate about wanting to do something about this issue. And we feel increasingly that we need to start moving beyond a conversation about this being a crisis, and instead we need to start thinking about how can we cooperate, how can we bring reciprocity into the conversation about refugees, how can we ensure that we look at refugees as bringing opportunities, that the skills that they have are something that we can build on and share. How can we ensure that refugees can work so that they can contribute, so they can have dignity and be able to make a valid contribution to society? I just wanted to kind of present this because obviously we've been doing a lot of work in Athens, and I really feel like there are 2 sides to the story. On the one hand, you see in the press these horrible stories of parents who feel so anxious about the refugee children coming to their children's school that they will actually go to the lengths of padlocking the school, they will throw stones, they'll have sit-ins to prevent those children attending the school. And that, on that one, the one hand, that's a horrible situation. But on the other hand, we've seen in Athens this wonderful resilience, this real strength of the civil society, the community that's coming together that really wants to do something. We took all of the summit delegates in this coach, and we went all the way down to this place called The Cube in Athens, and it's been set up by these two entrepreneurs, and it was a fantastic space. They've set up what's called a SOL, a self-organized learning environment, and they bring refugee children in and their parents, and they work with them on their education. Now it's not a formal education. They're limited as to what they can offer. But it's something, it's a start, it's an opportunity to stop children being bored. And when we were there, it was incredible to speak to these kids. They can speak really excellent English, and they've only been in Greece for a short period of time. And they have an opportunity to ask questions, to think about the world. And one of the really wonderful things, I think, about the way that we have been able to connect all of these different networks in the city space is that, speaking just last week actually to ACS Athens, they said they've now got a formal partnership with the Cube, and they're supporting them and helping them, as well as the Hope School where Deo works. So we wanted to explore this a bit more in our report, and you I hope will be able to see in the next couple of weeks when it comes out. And we've developed a bit of a typology that looks at all the different city players. So we look at the kind of the global conveners, the collaborators. We look at the resource providers, people who can provide kind of technology, the community hubs that are operating like the Cube, and of course the educational professionals themselves, the people like Deia, and as well as many other sort of teachers, and then also the experts who we can go to who can tell us more about the way that we should be approaching refugee education. Clearly, we know that this is a huge, huge challenge, and like Kevin and Charlotte were saying, we need a long-term approach to this. But we feel that there is a huge amount to build on in the city space to develop these networks of reciprocity that are already there but just need to be strengthened and to grow further. And I just wanted to end with this quote because I think it's rather a nice way of rounding this off and also thinking about the role of schools. So we live in a world in which the capacity to innovate will be more important than ever. Sustained innovation does not come from lone individuals. Sustained innovation comes from creative communities of passionate and committed people, creative communities which share an animating sense of purpose and a cause. That's true of great companies, cities, teams, and it should also be true of great schools too.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alice. And last but certainly not least, we have Gowadi, who I hope can reflect on some of your experiences as a former political refugee and your experiences of education, the barriers and opportunities and the importance of it for you and what you're doing now.
Thank you. Good evening. It's always difficult to follow some excellent speakers. I should have spoke first. thank you. It's great to be here, and thank you for organizing this event. I think we talk about this issue of, you know, education in emergencies as something far away, but actually, you know, it's quite close to home in Athens, in Europe. And I've written this book, The Lightless Sky, advertising it, so I hope you get a chance to read it. It's a story of my life traveling from Afghanistan to Britain at the age of 12 as a child refugee. I'm still actually a refugee. It took me a year to get here, and unfortunately, along the way, I was treated really badly. Forget being treated as a child. I wasn't even treated as a human. And the authorities across Europe, I made it to Britain. It was a struggle. This was the beginning of an end. This was another battle. So the experience for me, education is one of the best way to get out of a cycle of poverty and get out of a situation where a lot of refugees find themselves in. So I remember when I got first to the UK, it took me about 2 years to get into a mainstream school because the Home Office and Social Services, although they were trying to help me, but they did not believe my age, that I was 13. They did not believe I was even an Afghan. So there are barriers and obstacles created by the system. So, and then now I just graduated from the University of Manchester. I never, ever imagined that I will get to a position where I will graduate and, you know, write a book, which I've been published in 6 languages, travel the world. But this all been possible because of teachers and people who believed in me. And also because of my willingness and hard work and determination to succeed because I felt education will be the only way to give me this access to the future, to become successful, to be able to rebuild Afghanistan one day. And I think here we heard about Syria and South Sudan and in other places. But I feel like Afghanistan has been forgotten. There's been a war and conflict for the last 5 decades, and Afghans used to be the largest refugee population in the world. And now they're the second largest refugee population in asylum seekers, and we have huge crises of education. So I think, yes, we need to support and help countries to better deal with refugees and treat them as people, you know, treat them and see them as a potential investment rather than seeing them as burden. And the problem I have with Europe and Britain is that when I got here, because of the Home Office and because of social services and the situation around immigration, how I was seen as a statistic, as a number, rather than someone valuable, a valuable human being who can make a contribution. I mean, in the last 6-7 years, I haven't remembered a day not giving something back to society because I feel so grateful. And whenever I got the chance to go to the school in Bolton, that's where I live now, it was a school for international arrivals. It was a place called Starting Point. And it was a great place. They had people from across the world coming in to Bolton or around area to be able to integrate and to learn about British mainstream education. In the centre will then send them to secondary schools, primary schools and colleges. But unfortunately, this has been recently closed. It was the only very unique centre in the whole of the UK created or set up. And because of fundings or cuts, it was the first thing to be closed. And I think it was a great example of good practice, because I spent a year there because of my age dispute and other issues. But when I went to my secondary school, I worked really, really hard. But also, although my school in Bolton was very diverse, but there were issues around, they didn't have a system in place. So, for example, they put me in a German class. I needed to learn English, but they were putting me in a German class. I was like, the German class really liked me, and English is my fifth language. I wanted to learn more languages, of course. But I needed to first learn English. So there was issues around how practicality in making sure that I was able to. And then I managed with work, hard work, and commitment. I managed to get 10 GCSEs, all 8 Cs. And there were people in my class who were born here. English was their first language. They didn't do it because they didn't value or realize the importance of education. So I didn't take it for granted. And I go out and talk to school. And of course, you know, working with their worlds and World at School, the companion advocacy that we do, as you know, basically no one should be out of school. And school can't wait. So when you are traveling, when you are leaving a conflict zone, when you are leaving a war zone, and I have friends who came with me, ended up in prisons. I ended up doing the wrong things because they didn't have the opportunity or they didn't have the help and support that I had in the beginning. But so I think if we, let's not go so far in Britain, if we allowed refugees to get education. For example, my refugee status expires next year, and the government has bring these policies up, safe return reviews. So now I'm in a situation where whether they will give me a status or not, whether I'll be allowed to settle. So there's so much uncertainty and instability. Actually, I had to wait 5 years to get my refugee status. So when I was at college doing my A-levels, I was stressed out about it. And then I didn't have status. I went to university. Manchester said, well, we'll have you, but you had to find £13,000. And I said, well, I don't have £13,000. And then the government, because I didn't have refugee status, I wasn't allowed to study. And then when I got my refugee status, I was able to go and continue my studies. And I hope to go and do masters and not only contribute to the UK here through my education and experiences, but I want to take it back to Afghanistan. So the message is quite simple. We need to be talking about the causes of the problem. I think education is certainly one of the most important things that we can help to rebuild countries and end wars and conflicts. But the bigger picture is we need to be talking about how can we end conflicts in Syria. Syria was a place where actually they had Iraqis and Palestinians and Lebanese refugees, and now they themselves are refugees. I dedicated my book to the 65 million refugees and displaced people. And I mean, just in the last few years, over 95,000 children entered Europe and 10,000 got missing. So the problem is, I think we have huge issues in Europe as well as across the world. And I think we need to act collectively, work with the UN. And I think we need to have initiatives where the local people can contribute. So I think one of the biggest support that I had was from mentors, from people who are not actually my formal teachers, but people in the community are trying to support me, encourage me, and motivate me to achieve. So I hope you will support the campaign of Their World and our World at School, which is very important. And also, as everyone was leaving us with a thought, I leave you with a thought that one pen, one book, and one teacher, as Malala says, will change the world.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you very much for sharing your inspirational journey and reminding us very much of the importance of collaboration, as well as people, teachers, mentors who stepped up to support you and others, I'm sure. We will go straight to questions and we'll take two at a time if that works for everybody. Okay, hello.
Hi, thanks. My name's Claudia Barwell. I'm from Sukla, but I'm also co-founder of OPI Festival. And OPI as a community are really interested in refugee education. We have been working all year on some ideas of things that we can do to support refugee education. I know that this room will be entirely passionate about that as a subject, which is why you're here. And what I want to know is how we can help. We understand the problem. We really get it. All of us. What we want to know is exactly how, where are the areas of weakness, because there is masses of money available for this worldwide. I don't quite agree with Charlotte. I think that there is areas where technology can hugely help this problem. And I've recently been with the Brookings Institute with some examples of children in Sudan who are massively benefiting from technology in education where there isn't a teacher available. But what I would like to know from either the panel or from the people in the room, Selena, is what we as a community can do to help, because OPI will help action that somehow, because we all care and want to make it better.
My name's Graham Smith. I've spent much of the last 25 years working in London schools with large numbers of refugees. And I think it would be remiss of us if we didn't acknowledge, as we're in London, that London schools actually do a very good job, probably a better job than Bolton schools, if I can just be a little bit kind of London-centric about it, in dealing with the needs of refugee pupils. They are very inclusive. They don't park them off somewhere else. They bring them in so they can learn alongside other children. They recognise the huge skills that those young people bring with them. What they've learnt from what are often the very difficult experience if they've had actually makes them very good learners, because they're immensely resilient. And in fact, London schools do it so well that, I mean, one of the things I do currently is export their expertise to Denmark, where whilst they may be taking in proportionally far more refugee children than, unfortunately, our country isn't, and disgracefully it isn't at the moment, they don't actually know what to do with them when they get them. And I think I'd also want to suggest that some of the principles that make things work well in London would work in all forms of refugee education wherever. And the first one is that it's inclusive, it's not separate. Children are children. They deserve to be with other children and taught alongside them. And if we can do that, I think we make a good start.
Thank you. Does anybody want to begin with responding to either question? Let's take Claudia's question of what can we do?
It's obviously incredibly challenging to kind of come up with a sort of simple answer to this, but I think there is a huge amount that we can do, and I think the thing that our report tried to show was that the reciprocity is really important, and we need to start encouraging organisations to say more about what they need, and then to be able to find an avenue to share that. And that was something that at the summit, the TechFugees, for example, there was a representative there, and they were trying to see whether they could set up some kind of portal where you could actually say, this is what I can offer, and then see what other organisations needed. And I think that kind of framework is, I don't know if that, I haven't come across that existing, but I think something like that would be really beneficial, because sometimes it can be something quite, it can seem relatively small, but it could be a voice of support, or it could be an opportunity to share some resources, or it can be a chance to kind of go and to volunteer. It's not just about giving money. There are a whole range of different things that different organisations need. But it's obviously challenging because it's very varied in different cities and in different places. There are organisations like the Red Cross, like Save the Children, like many others that are doing really fantastic work and that want volunteers and that need extra support. I don't know whether Charlotte can say a little bit more about that.
Sorry, one of the things I understand about refugee education and the stats that are now coming out of it, because unfortunately we have stats, is that volunteer support doesn't particularly work, and that it needs to be something that's much more embedded. And the OPI community, for example, have been working on a passport, some digital thing that gives the credentials. If you're migrant and you're moving and you're moving, you need credentials that are going to stay with you. And you need something that gives you a level. And what I suppose I'm asking of the panel is if you had the one thing that you could wave a wand at and go, OK, if we could do this, because then I'm sure there's people in this room that could mobilise. I've got, there's people nodding, good, but the people will mobilise and do that.
I don't think there's a one thing magic bullet here, to be honest with you, but there are organisations that are really trying to tackle this crisis head on, and that includes Save the Children, it includes Their World, it includes many others. We're going to be launching a major campaign next year with the ambition of getting every refugee child back into primary school, into early learning opportunities and so on. So, you know, you'd expect me to say this. I'm CEO of Save the Children, so come and join us and make a difference. I'd also say we've got an election coming up and a lot of people are going to be knocking on your doors. Ask them what they think of the 0.7 commitment on aid and what they'll be doing to put this issue at the top of Britain's aid agenda in the years ahead. So I think that's something all of us can do to send that signal to our political representatives. And I do think, without wanting to get into London-Bolton rivalries here, the school leadership is absolutely critical in this, because you can come up with any plan that you want, but if you have the wrong school leadership model, the wrong type of approaches, you have the sort of damage that you were describing, actually.
You got it right at the end.
But, you know, this idea of having separate classes of refugee students. Now, you know, a country like Lebanon, you know, I had the opportunity to work with the government in Lebanon on this second shift system. The one thing I never liked about it was that it basically put refugee children into the second shift. Some of them went into the first shift, but most of them went into the second shift. Now, that is not an inclusive approach. And what you're describing, I think, can address that. So the more that we can link schools together, you know, I think is what we need, is absolutely critical. And the very last point I'd make, you know, a lot of this comes down to attitudes. And one of the things that horrifies me most about many of the discussions I end up in here in the UK is this sense of fear and hostility, threat, whatever the right form of words is, as though the UK is at the epicentre of a global refugee crisis. I mean, the UK is the outer planet of this crisis. Yeah. You know, 90% of refugees are sitting in low-income countries and middle-income countries, and we need to, I think, increase awareness of our global responsibility to address this problem.
The problem we have is there are 120 million or so children in the world who doesn't have access to education because of conflict zone, and they deserve better. It's their human rights to have access to education. I think about the UK, it's not only about children. The government has actually made cuts to adult English classes. We want people to integrate. How will they integrate if they don't have language skills? So the Refugee Action, Refugee Council and other refugee charities is campaigning to get the government to support and provide more funding for adult English classes. It's a very simple thing. And also, I think education not only enables you to get opportunities in integration. I mean, because of me going to school, and my school has actually been amazing, that my school is called Easter Academy, and I've been going over to Sweden with my school to try to, because we are one of the only school in the country who uses Apple technology, so everyone have iPads. And we are going to Sweden to help the government and educators there how they could help integrate refugee and unaccompanied minors into the education system, because Sweden has the most number of high numbers of unaccompanied asylum seekers, and they don't know how to deal with it. And I completely agree, having people in classes, I think I was empowered and inspired, and I was even more motivated to work hard, to compete with my peers who, I mean, I had to catch up. I started in year 10, and they had many years of experience, and I didn't speak a word of English. I'm still learning, but I think we need to support campaigns like, you know, the Their World, and everyone should be at school, as well as the refugee organizations. And what little things makes a difference is that there are a lot of asylum seekers who are, you know, destitute, who doesn't have status, who doesn't have papers, and they are living in food banks, they're living in charities, and they will appreciate some help with education, not only young people, but also adults. So I think mentors and people who could volunteer their time with refugee welcome charities, that would be a great help, actually.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you. Hello, my name's Hannah. Thank you for your thoughts this evening. I work for Save the Children, actually, so it's really great to hear more about the work in this area. I had a question which Charlotte actually touched on already, which was how the panel see the role of the private sector partners in education for refugee children, both in terms of the issue of underfunding, but also quality.
Great. At the back.
Hi, my name is Laurie Forcier. I work at Pearson. I have a question for Kevin. You talked about the proportion of funding that's currently allocated to education being around 1 or 2%, and then only about half of that actually making it there. Could you talk a little bit about, I'm a relative novice to this area. I'd love to know what the other 98% is going to, what's being prioritized, and what would you deprioritize in that context?
Thank you. And one last question.
Hi, I'm Manita from Save the Children. Are there specific requirements in terms of the teachers and the sorts of skills that they need to have in terms of bringing children in, making them inclusive and ensuring that they are integrated and then they get the right sorts of skills themselves?
Let's take the first question about private sector partnerships. Does anyone want to reflect on that?
Sure. Well, we actually have a partnership with Pearson, as it happens, which we're incredibly proud of. And what that partnership is doing, it is bringing some of the great technologies that are available within reach of kids who would otherwise have no prospect of getting them. So these are tablets. So rather than having to invest in very expensive large numbers of books, which may not be available, having that available. There are all sorts of virtual learning technologies that can be applied in refugee camps like Zaatari and elsewhere. So the fact that the private sector is at the cutting edge of developing those technologies with the potential to adapt them to the environments that we're talking about, I think is really important. We're not going to solve this problem without the private sector. On the funding question, I think it's two separate things. So, recently I've been in northeast Nigeria and Somalia, and I can fully understand why in humanitarian appeals in those contexts where people are starving, large numbers of children are threatened with starvation, of course it's right to prioritise nutrition, water and sanitation and that sort of thing. When you're talking about contexts like, as Charlotte mentioned, Dadaab camp in Kenya, or the Syrian refugees that are in Amman, or in the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon, these are very long-term, long-running emergency situations. And the humanitarian system is just not geared up to deal with it. What you need to plan a large-scale response is predictable funding. If you think, say, in the corporate sector, if you were planning a delivery to a group, like the 1.5 million South Sudanese children who need support, you'd want predictable funding so that you can hire teachers, you can put in place the structures, you can meet the recurrent costs, you can make the capital costs, not just for one term, but for a full school year, and then for the next school year, and for the next school year. Now, the way that humanitarian funding works is that what's on offer is 6 months of funding, followed by another application, and if you're lucky, you might get another 6 months. If you're unlucky, you won't. And it's this bridge between long-term development financing and the immediate humanitarian funding that's missing. And the way to deal with it, I think, it's not to take from health and put it into education, it's to expand the cake. And that's why the proposal that Gordon Brown has developed is so important. It's why the role of the World Bank, which now has this crisis window in its lending facility for low-income countries, is so important and needs to do more in education. And it's why bilateral donors, like the UK and other countries, also need to do more for refugee education. So this isn't about trade-offs. This is about expanding the cake for everybody.
Just a couple of things, I think, as well on the private sector. Obviously, the funding is a great asset, but I think there's so much more that can be done. And I know Pearson has done this and really engaged the members and the staff of Pearson in the work of Save the Children. And I think that is a great way to actually create activists as well around a cause and to try and get get the skills. I think also there's, you know, there's often something that the private sector can offer, which we don't necessarily, as Save the Children, we might not have that specific expertise or skills. So I think bridging that gap and kind of navigating the humanitarian, complex humanitarian system can be a great way to find specific solutions to some of these problems. And yes, yeah, as I said, kind of the technical expertise and skills. Just on your point about teacher skills, I think often teachers are neglected and we focus so much on children and what they've been through. But recognising that teachers are also parents, also members of the community who've been through harrowing and horrific events and are struggling with their own lives and trying to get their own lives back on track. And often what we see is suspension of teacher payments. So they might be a volunteer teacher and get a stipend, but no actual support. So I think the first thing is making sure that we're actually paying teachers properly and that there is a provision for that within the ministry. But providing the psychosocial support that we provide to children, to adults as well, and to teachers, if they are the ones who are going to be supporting learners and children, they too have got to have that support and have that well-being. We really neglect teacher well-being. And how can you have a teacher who's able to provide support to children if they themselves are not fit and well? And then, you know, all sorts of things. I mean, I could have gone on for hours about all of the challenges, but around providing large class sizes. So, you know, recognising that how do you integrate? How do you make your classroom inclusive if you've got 20 learners who don't speak a word of English? Where do you start? Do you start with a few basic words and shove them in the corner? You know, how do you include them? So I think just trying to create some of the, you know, support them with some of those strategies for how you approach different abilities, different learners, and you know, again, using skills of people who've done that. And thinking about language of instruction as well. So is it that you've got mentors or a specific support? And I think Jordan has actually done that very well with Syrian classroom assistants who support individual children and learners. So that can be one way. But, yeah, we cannot neglect teachers when we think about education. And I think the leadership aspect of that, having strong head teachers, strong school management committees and parent-teacher committees is absolutely key.
Great. Just final thoughts. So when I was at school, of course, the classroom helped being in the whole class, but I also had extra revision classes. So, for example, rather than going to science, I went to English, or rather than going to PE, I did some extra English up to school during weekends. That really helped. But also, I think we expect so much from teachers. Teachers are not superhumans. They don't know everything. And I think sometimes it's important for them to understand the refugee background. Sometimes they expect too much from refugees. So I think it's important for them to read books like The Lightless Sky to understand the story behind it and to have a better understanding. And also, I think the UK should be leading in this humanitarian or this educational crisis. I mean, we're the fifth richest country in the world, and if we are not leading, how can we encourage others to lead? So I think education can't wait. We need to get our MPs and government to act and put their words to action. I think there are so many governments around the world, they pledge, but then they don't deliver. And that's why we have to make them accountable.
I think that's a good place as any to end. Thank you very, very much. I'd like to thank everybody for your thoughtful questions and comments tonight. I'd also like to thank teams at ECIS and Save the Children once again for their support in putting this event together. Please do check out the RSA website for updates on our work and news of the forthcoming report, Cities of Reciprocity, and of course the Promising Practices site for resources and information on some of the most innovative work that the campaign is highlighting. Please finally join me once again in thanking our speakers, Alice, Kevin, Gulwali and Charlotte. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.